Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Stuff, stuff, and more stuff. You may have so much of it, you may get a storage locker. Problem solved, right? Well, you may not even realize how much you are spending on your storage unit in a year until you do the calculation, and you're not going to like what you see. Rob Carrick is a personal finance columnist for the Globe and Mail, and he wrote about why he said goodbye to his storage locker. He's here to talk about that. If you're someone who's new to the world of personal finance, or you want to get a little more knowledge than just the magic and insight of this radio show, you might be thinking of investing in a financial course. But it turns out there are free courses available, lots of them, courses in Canada. Lisa Hanam is the executive editor of MoneySense.ca. She wrote about some of the best personal finance courses in Canada, and we're going to talk about which those are. Then, tips for making better decisions when it comes to investing. Financial advisor Jonathan K. DeYo shares some of his tips from his latest book, Mindful Investing: Right Focus, Better Outcome, Greater Well-Being. Plus, a new tax you might have to pay. It's called the Underused Housing Tax. Jason Heath is a fee-only, advice-only certified financial planner. He's with Objective Financial Partners, and he's here to tell us who it's for and how it works. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. The storage industry in Canada alone brings in something like $1.2 billion a year. It's an unimaginable sum to me. That is a lot of old letters and tchotchkes and holiday decorations and camping equipment and all that stuff. And that number is growing at least 6% a year, growing and growing. Great if you run a self-storage franchise. Not so great if you're trying to make ends meet, especially in these times. Rob Carrick is personal finance columnist for the Globe and Mail, and he recently said goodbye to his family's storage unit. He's here to talk about his experience, the dollars he saved, and the hidden cost of things like storage. He's in Ottawa. Hello, Rob.
Hello, Bruce.
Why did you decide to shut down your storage locker?
It costs $95 a month. Do I need to say any more than that?
You don't. Anyone who knows you knows that's enough. But now, this was not a storage locker you had since your 20s. You had like a short-term reason to have a storage locker.
Yeah, we were transitioning from our family home to a condo, and to smooth the way, we stashed some things in a storage locker. It was our stuff, my wife and I, and also our two adult sons in their 20s had some stuff. And we just thought, we'll get this unit, we'll throw a bunch of junk in there, and we'll deal with it in due course. And it was getting on 4 years later, and I thought, enough is enough. And we took a couple trips out there to inspect what was there and began to realize that there was some non-essentials there. We came up with a plan to get rid of it all. And then we had that great moment at the end of the this past summer when I went to the front desk and I said, over and out, we are done.
Yes.
And it's all yours. And they immediately got into the computer, took us off the billing list, and I have not heard from them since.
Wow, what a delight. Almost like found money. Tell us about your process. How did you approach this? Because if I were to oversimplify, there's like, you know, you're going to clear out one box a week and have it be done in a couple of months. And another one is book your Saturday and Sunday, everybody. We're driving the stuff to Restore.
I would say don't go for the do it all in one day. It's too overwhelming in an emotional sense and in a practical sense. What I start off by doing, here's what we did, and I think it worked out really well. Go visit your storage locker, take a lot of pictures, and then you come back and you can sort of strategize. Okay, we could put this box there and this box here, and that box can go into the garbage and that box can be donated. And think about it, and then attack it like over a few weekends. It doesn't have to be all in a row. And deal with it in bits and pieces. And then all of a sudden it seems to become very doable because you'll get critical mass and you'll think, okay, we had 100 boxes, we're down to 10, and then I can sort of chart a path to zero.
There are people, and I count myself among them, who are deeply sentimental to stuff. And I'm not a hoarder. My husband's a minimalist, so I couldn't be a hoarder. But I do have a real resonance for things from my childhood, for example. How did you and your family navigate some of those emotional decisions that aren't logical? You're never going to wear that thing again, and it's not going to be useful to anyone after you die. Were there some tough choices for you?
You know what? We there were the core emotional things like photographs and stuff from when our boys were really little, and books like for kids and such. We found space for them. We just shoehorned them into our condo storage locker or our cupboards or shelves. We thought, too important. We're keeping it. We'll just find a place. But you know, when you go back to your locker over time and you look at things and you think, I thought that was really important, but I haven't touched it or thought about it in the past 12 months. That makes it easier to get rid of it.
Yeah. One of the benefits of the storage locker is that you don't have to see the stuff anymore. You can pretend that you don't have the stuff because it's in a storage locker there. Do you think people forget they're paying this amount of money because it's not like right there? If it was, you know, a storage container that they had to walk past that they were paying $95 a month for, would it be easier to be better aware of the money going down the drain?
I think it definitely would. And I really think you're onto something in terms of you get used to this monthly payment. It becomes just one more household expense that you're used to. It's like how people carry this permadebt on their home equity lines of credit. They just get used to paying that interest every month. It becomes sort of an expense just like the phone or hydro or heat. But, you know, and I have to say I fell into that trap for a little while. You just got used to that. But it just hit me at one point, and I thought, $95. So here's inflation, and it's eroding our living standard. Our money's going less far. What can we do to cut costs to sort of offset that? And boom, I saw this. It jumped out at me, and I thought, let's do this. It's very doable. And now I feel like I've sort of punched back a little bit against rising prices.
Yeah. Now, this doesn't sound like it was the case in your situation, but for some people, there are assets in there, maybe not like, you know, gold bullion or anything, but a dining room table that could collect $100 on Facebook Marketplace, or I don't know, some other items of value. Is there a case to be made that this could not only be a cost saver in terms of cash burn, but could throw some cash in your pocket on stuff you could sell?
Absolutely. You know what? I would go there with your phone and take a bunch of pictures and try putting it on Kijiji. Or see, in our neighborhood in Ottawa, there is a neighborhood sort of message board. And we've had a lot of success of just putting things up there. And sometimes within minutes, someone contacts you, yes, I'll buy that. You know, I'm not going to say it's been a huge money maker, but it's a way to convert small, interesting things, or even larger ones, to cash. And I strongly encourage people to do it. I think this sort of second-handing idea is really catching on in this inflationary world. And yes, you might be able to turn some of this into cash. And if it doesn't work out that you turn it into cash, maybe you can get somebody to pick it up and you give it away for free, and you make somebody happy by giving them something that really means something to them. And you've got it out of your storage locker, out of your garage, and it's over and out.
Yeah. One of the ideas we created with my mom when she was downsizing from her family home was we created this archetype of a young woman who needed stuff, and we called her Hannah. So as I was, you know, holding up the vase or the salad bowl or the pair of winter mitts, I would say to my mom, what do you think? Do you think Hannah could use this? And it was much easier for my mom to think she was making a contribution to a young woman who needed a pair of winter mitts than, you know, letting go of something that had been so important to her. Rob, you have a very active following in terms of your readers. What did people say? $95? Deal of the century? I pay, what, $250?
Well, you know what? We did have the smallest storage locker, Bruce, the smallest one possible. It was still pretty big. You could have easily got like a couple of refrigerators in there. But here's an interesting story, though. We went to the storage complex, and we hadn't been in a while. And in the interim, they had built a whole add-on facility the size of a giant factory. It's like, I think you could make cars in this building. It was so big. And that was added on after we sort of came in. So not only are there bigger storage lockers, but now there's a whole other giant complex of storage lockers in the same location. So there's people paying way more than we are. Look, you know, I don't judge people. Sometimes you're in a jackpot. You need to find a place for things that you consider valuable. But I would encourage everyone to think about the end game. Don't make it permanent. It's just too much money.
Do you think this is part of our never-ending drive to consume, like buy more stuff, we gotta buy more stuff? There's this one in, one out rule, like you buy a sweater and then you have to get rid of a sweater. So we have a lower likelihood of falling into a situation where you need a storage locker, or even worse, you need a bigger house.
You know, I think part of the issue is that we, you know, the Canadian style house is usually pretty large. We have basements, we have lots of cupboard space. And it encourages us to accumulate. And I think you're right on. In our case, we moved to a condo. It's a smaller living space, and it's really helped us differentiate between what we really need and what we can live without. And you get into this mindset, like you just said, where something comes into the place, something goes out. And I would really encourage people to try that. You know what? It's very freeing to get rid of your things.
Mm. Yeah, you're 100% right. Rob, thank you for joining us to talk about your story.
Glad to do it, Bruce.
Rob Carrick is a personal finance columnist at the Globe and Mail. His personal quest to save $95 a month, $1,200 a year. Not bad. If you are liking what you heard today, you can never miss an episode. Make sure you never, ever miss an episode. And here's how you can do that. Head over to moolala.ca. On that site, you can listen to past episodes, past segments. You can also search by keyword or guest name. Or you can go to any of the podcast platforms out there, Spotify, Amazon Prime, wherever else you listen to podcasts, and download any of the episodes, leave a review, subscribe, do all the things.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolah Law, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. They say there is no such thing as a free lunch, but what about a free personal finance course? Well, there is, in fact, such a thing. And today we're going to talk about some of them. Lisa Hannum is the executive editor at moneysense.ca, and she has put together a list of some of the very best free courses available to Canadians. She's here now to talk about them. Hello, Lisa.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me today.
It's our pleasure. I am a big fan of learning of all kinds, of course. Personal finance courses online, amazing, easy to do in the comfy of your home and in your jammies. What do you think are the benefits of taking a course like this?
Well, first and foremost, it's financial literacy. You essentially are learning about your own situation, as well as like the options that you have outside of what you may know you have access to. And I really feel like it points out the difference between knowledge and confidence. When you take a personal finance course, you actually know if your confidence is warranted or not. It's not just about making decisions, but like having the knowledge to back up and knowing when you should be making that decision, or if you need some guidance from a professional.
It's such a great question. Like, a part of me is like, in other areas of my life, I don't want to know if my confidence is merited. I just want to strut on through and be like, hello, I am basically a runway model. But I understand what you're talking about. That makes total sense. As you surveyed the landscape, looking at the courses out there, what were some of the things that you, some of the criteria that you considered? I mean, free is great, but you could also argue you get what you pay for.
know for sure. So we did come up with a methodology, and free was obviously the first and foremost. But the second thing we obviously wanted to include as well was that it came from a quality educator and that they have the authority to speak and teach on these topics. Another criteria we wanted was that the ability to provide lessons that were useful and relevant to Canadians. You can take a free course anywhere in the world, but is it useful to Canadians? Not always, right? So we also wanted it to be accessible, whether that's online or in person at multiple locations.
Okay. And the first name on your list, this is one I'm familiar with, fits all three of those criteria. It's a program out of McGill. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it's the McGill Personal Finance Essentials, and it's actually taught by their professors. So it's the closest to a university course that you would get in the list of free personal finance courses in Canada, which is super cool.
Yeah. What are some of the things they talk about? And are they like your groovy, cool professor, or are they the one that you probably never met because the class started at 8:30 a.m. and there was no way you were showing up?
It's a bit of everything, to be honest, because each lesson is taught by a different professor. So there are things like budgeting and saving. There is spending your money for today and tomorrow, understanding the difference between debt and borrowing. The art of investing was a fun title. We also have retirement planning, the realities of real estate, and behavioral finance, which is where that confidence thing comes into play. This year, though, they have two new bonus lessons, one on responsible investing, which is a huge topic with like ESG and like people wanting more from their investments from a climate standpoint, and ethical as well. The other bonus lesson is cryptocurrencies and crypto tokens. So this is highly of interest.
Talk about an area where people have overinflated confidence. Holy moly. And when you look at the modules in that program, are they, you know, super fast, TikTokable, bite-sized little snacks, or are they a full-on 90-minute lecture times seven?
It's a bit of both. So all of these courses that we have are go at your own pace. So if you only have that TikTok minute, then you can definitely like sign in to any of these courses and do whatever time you have. What I found personally helpful when I take any courses is to schedule it into my calendar, especially the go at your pace, right? Mm.
Yeah. Otherwise you never get it done because it's just not going to be a priority. So moving on from the McGill Personal Finance Essentials, the best free Canadian income tax course that you found is from the government of Canada. What are you even talking about?
Yeah. So we may as well get it from the horse's mouth, so they say, right?
Yeah.
So the government of Canada has a personal income tax course called Learn About Your Taxes. So this is another.
Oh my God, that is the most boring title of a course I've ever heard.
To be honest, though, it's probably one of the best skills you can have as a Canadian when it comes to your money. I think anyway, I do my own taxes, so I love it.
And what are some of the things that they cover, and how would you manage people's expectations in terms of presentation? I mean, my stereotype about what the government will provide is going to be super generic.
Fair. So this one is actually quite interactive in that they give you a lesson, and then at the end of it, you'll have like a questionnaire. There are also videos with actual talking heads, not just marker. I don't know if you've seen some of the videos with just marker statements, but they have talking heads in it. So there will be someone talking to you. This one is actually geared to people who are just starting to work so that they understand what's coming off their paycheck, how to complete a basic tax return, what to expect when like you send in your return, how to use the My Account, which is a super important one. I don't know if you've ever logged onto My Account, That's a very good one to like understand your way around.
Yeah, 100%. The best free course for managing debt comes from another nonprofit credit counseling agency. It's called Credit Counseling Society. They're based in British Columbia. They are great. It's called The Truth About Credit. That's a better title for the record. That's a better title.
The Truth About Taxes. We should submit.
That's it. That's better. Okay. We'll give them that feedback.
So The Truth About Credit, it's more like slideshows and like walking through different place cards and stuff. So that one is a bit more like user-friendly in the sense that you're not going through complicated things. It's really coming out, learning about how a credit card works, how a credit works in Canada, as well as credit scores, how to read a credit report, where your credit rating comes from, and even how to access your credit report for free.
All very, very important and helpful things. You've got a course here for young Canadians. Personal finance course for young Canadians. Tell us about the Desjardins program.
Yes. So this one's called Desjardins Personal Finance, I'm in Charge. It's aimed for Canadians aged 16 to 25. What I love about this one is that you can take it as a group. So if you have a teacher or if you have a teacher who has a class and you want to do this with your class, it's an easy thing to do. You can sign up as a group. It is also taught in person at over 114 different educator partners in English and in French, which is very rare as well. So for example, in Toronto, it'll be at the YWCA. And there's also at the Option Travail in Quebec City, as well as other ones.
Wow. Some of the other material out there in the marketplace Desjardins, they're a financial institution. There are a lot of financial institutions that offer learning, self-directed, live, in person, many, many options. Is there a caution or a thought or something that you would say about material offered by those who have skin in the game, which is not the case for McGill, it's not the case for Credit Counseling Society?
No, that's very true. So I have been to different sessions where a bank will provide like a learning Q&A with some of their advisors. So the one caveat with that, though, is that they're talking about the products that they sell. So it's not like Avon is recommending another beauty product. It's not like going into a pub and buying a beer next door. You are only buying into what they are selling.
Who are the people for whom a course makes sense? Like, what's our rally cry here? Should everyone take one? Should you take one once a year?
Well, that's a great idea. Generally, these are for anyone unless there's age restrictions around it. But how I think of it when we were creating the list, we were creating this for people who wanted to make financial changes in their situation, whether that is invest in a new asset class or even start investing at all, if they were trying to get out of debt or made the decision to do their own taxes. It could also be if you're dealing with a new situation, such as moving to Canada, and you're not really sure how it works here, or if you're becoming financially independent, like moving out on your own, or maybe you suddenly become single. It could also be changes of income, whether like you have an increase in salary, or maybe you recently lost a job and you just want to be like preventative with your finances. And I don't know about you, but there's a lot of news happening right now that can seem overwhelming. And I find that these courses are great for putting perspective on the things that you can and can't control with your money.
Yeah. It almost sounds like a compliment to that. I mean, Money Sense has decades, literally decades of material that you have been writing and customizing and tweaking based on every single personal finance issue or opportunity one can imagine. It seems like these courses would be a good complement to then the kind of stuff that Money Sense publishes.
Yeah, no, exactly. When we were coming up with our September content, we were trying to figure out like how to bring back to school to everyone. And this just made such good sense for anyone who wanted to give themselves a bit of a challenge with it, with their finances.
Really great. Lisa, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Lisa Hannan is the executive editor of MoneySense.ca. She was here to talk about her piece on the best personal finance courses in Canada. We talked about one from McGill. We talked about one from Credit Counseling Society. We talked about one from Desjardins. Do a little Google search and find Lisa's article online.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Stay with us. Coming up later, all you need to know about the underused housing tax. It's not that the tax is underused, it's the housing that is underused. You got to be careful there about, is that an adjective? I think it is. Lisa would know. Jason Heath is a certified financial planner. He's going to join us to talk about that. But first, financial advisor Jonathan K. DeYo talks about his book, Mindful Investing: Right Focus, Better Outcome, Greater Well-Being. On Wednesday afternoons, live and in person, you should tune into another radio show, CBC. So every Wednesday afternoon on CBC Radio, I yatter about something money related. I'm the national money columnist and hang out with the hosts on all the afternoon shows. So if you're around in your car and you're going to dare to leave SiriusXM for a minute, come on over to CBC Radio.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
We all make mistakes when it comes to our investments. All of us, every single one of us, even I, have made a few in my time, some pretty brilliant ones, actually. So what are some ways you can reduce the likelihood of making mistakes, either minimizing the frequency or the gravity of those mistakes? Our next guest thinks mindfulness is important and could be a real critical component to reducing the number of mistakes that you make. Jonathan DeYo is a financial advisor and author of the book Mindful Investing: Right Focus, Better Outcome, Greater Well-Being. He joins us now from Berkeley, California to talk about the book and his tips. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
I love that you're in Berkeley, because it just connotes this like Alice Waters, oat milk, Crunchalicious, yoga pant wearing image. How far off am I? Am I like close, or did I just list a slew of unhelpful stereotypes?
They're all good stereotypes, but you know, they fit. I think they fit everywhere nowadays, though. Alice Waters is an incredible chef, great restaurants for sure. Yoga pants, absolutely. Mindfulness fits very well.
Yeah. Well, how do you define the word? I know I have a perception of the word, but in your view, how do you define it?
Mindfulness is the non-judgmental awareness of the present moment as it's experienced through our senses, thoughts, feelings. And I think that's a pretty standard traditional definition of mindfulness. And I think it fits here too.
Yeah. Okay. Non-judgmental. Got to work on that. What does it have to do with investing?
The benefit of mindfulness can be applied to basically anywhere where there's a need for a reduced stress response or more focus. And, you know, there really isn't another element of modern life that permeates our lives every hour of every day like money. And money creates stress and creates all sorts of, you know, when you're investing, especially when you're spending, there's, do I have enough? Can I make it? How much do I need? Should I buy this? Should I not buy this? Should I be saving this? How should I invest this? Should I buy equities now? Should I look at Bitcoin? What should I be doing? What should I be doing all the time? And at the same time, there's this side story where we're all sucked into social media. We're all paying attention to the headlines, and the headlines are always telling us, do something different, do something different, do something different. And this affects our investment outcomes. It affects our day-to-day thinking. It creates the situation in which our biases overwhelm us and we make mistakes. Your introduction talks about those mistakes. Mindfulness is the way around those mistakes.
Can you give us an example of a potential mistake and where mindfulness could mitigate the risk of us making that mistake?
Oh, easy. Like the world is rife with potential examples. The most recent, most vicious one is probably at the onset of the pandemic. So if we have a plan and our plan is to invest in a certain way, and we are investing in that way and we're happily going about our day doing so, and then something like the pandemic hits, we have an emotional response to the pandemic. And that emotional response to the pandemic begins to leak out of the fear of getting sick and affect all the decisions we make. It creates stress. It creates I fielded many, many phone calls like, Jonathan, this time is different. We have to go to cash. We have to change how we're investing money. And anybody, you can go back and look at this. In 30 days, we were down like 30 something percent in a 30-day window. And within 2 months, we were back to normal. And if you had made any kind of gut change reaction to your portfolio in that window, you would have decimated your outcomes.
If we were to apply this idea of mindfulness in a super literal way, we'd have like a meditation practice that was required before we were going to have our portfolio review or something like that. I'm over dramatizing it just for effect. What does this mean in practice? It is not necessarily lighting candles and putting on said yoga pants, but what does it look like?
So, I mean, there's research on this, right? So there's, I think mindfulness, the idea of mindfulness and some of the stereotypes around mindfulness come out of looking at older men in robes, you know, orange robes, white robes that are monks and meditating. Mindfulness, though, is thousands of years of tradition. And really the research and academics have been looking at this for a while now, is you just every single day spend 10 minutes sitting on a chair, maybe with your eyes closed, maybe with them downcast lightly, and just breathe. And when you do that and you pay attention to your breath and you notice when you are distracted and then bring your attention back to your breath, that's the whole point of breath meditation. Very, very simple. You focus on your breath. You notice that you're breathing. You feel the breath coming in. You feel the breath going out. You notice a thought comes in and you get distracted and you go off of your breath for a bit and you come back to your breath. That is a practice. And when you practice that, what ends up happening is when you are in places of stress or anxiety, maybe it's a conversation with a spouse, or could be a conversation with a child, or it could be your portfolio. Then if you can then retreat from that moment of stress and you can breathe for a second, you can calm your nervous system. And when you calm your nervous system, you're in a position to make better decisions. So it's actually practical sitting down as a practice, 10 minutes a day. It changes the physical structure of your brain. Your amygdala shrinks, your frontal cortex increases, literally the mass of the amygdala and the frontal cortex change. You are no longer as reactive. You are more able to deal with things that are coming your way that you don't expect.
What brought you to this? Were you raised on an ashram and there was never a moment of awakening for you? It was from birth, or do you have some glamorous, like the monk who drove the Ferrari moment?
I wish I had a glamorous moment. Now, I actually started off in my undergraduate career studying finance, and then I was pretty bored with that. And I said, you know what, I'm going to switch. And I tried, you know, literature for a while, and I ended up with philosophy. And I had a couple of great professors who said, Jonathan, you obviously like this stuff. Maybe comparative religion is something you should look at. And so I went to grad school. That's what brought me to Berkeley. I went to the Graduate Theological Union's Institute of Buddhist Studies. Ooh. And I learned how to meditate. I studied all the stuff and I spent a lot of time with it. And then I dropped out, and my first job out of grad school was Dean Witter. I was learning how to pitch stocks. I became part of the problem, because they would hire me, because they would hire anybody. So there's a couple people along the path, you know, John Dickens, who was very planning oriented and very thoughtful and very mindful, taught me a little bit. Another guy named Ernie Guzman said, hey, you don't have to do it the Wall Street way. You can do this business a different way. So I learned along the path a way to do it differently. And then, you know, I learned to integrate my training in mindfulness with noticing the conversations I was having with clients about their stresses around money. I was like, I wonder if mindfulness would fit into this. And turns out, you know, it fits perfectly. It is such a perfect space to practice mindfulness.
Have you noticed anecdotally that people for whom this is a value, like it's consistent with what they value, there is a connection to the sorts of things that they're interested in investing in? And I ask because it would seem to me that ESG might make more sense, or you know, I don't know, alternative energy is more interesting than puts and calls on the currency market in Asia. I just made that up out of a hat.
So yeah, for sure. There's a, when you say mindful money, it attracts a certain audience. There's no doubt about it. That audience has a much greater proclivity to think about ESG investing and has no interest whatsoever in options on foreign markets. That being said, part of the mindfulness is really understanding the structures of portfolios And we write about this in the book. There is a way to build a portfolio that actually provides better outcomes long-term with less stress. And I'm not making this up. I'm using tons of academics have done research on this, and I've just made it as simple as possible for folks. And so as long as you're following that path, the tools you use, whether they're ESG or pure index kind of tools, hardly matters at all. So you should embrace ESG if that's what you love. If you want to do something that's not ESG, I wouldn't beat yourself up about it. But yeah, the tendency is for folks that see mindfulness and money in the same sentence, yeah, they're going to be drawn more towards ESG. Yeah,
they probably don't have a lot of Altria in their portfolio.
Not a lot. That's the number one exclusion that I hear.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so you got three steps: planning, investing, and mindful patience. What does mindful patience mean?
It's a direct reference to basically the first question.
10 minutes a day, right?
Yeah, the 10 minutes a day. Well, the patience is when the thing is going to happen. And this applies both in investing and in spending, right? If you are going through a store and there's a thing there that's attractive, you want to buy the thing, you know, maybe don't buy it today. Maybe tell yourself, hey, if I still want this in 4 days or 5 days, I'll come back and get it. And 9 times out of 10, you won't. Like, that's a way to manage spending, but just by being patient and not making a change or not making the purchase. When the .com, or when, you know, oil collapsed, or when the pandemic occurred, or today, when we're looking at, I just wrote a piece called The Gathering Darkness. And I think that the next 13 months are going to be really, really rough and really, really volatile, and people are going to be scared, and the politics are going to drive people crazy here in the United States. And so there's going to be a lot of opportunity for people to practice impatience. There's going to be a news story that terrifies you. You're going to make a change in your portfolio because of that news story, or because of 10 news stories saying the same thing. And so patience is, hey, let's just sit on this for a bit. Let's just not make a change. We have a plan. We got a portfolio based on that plan. We shouldn't be making changes based on what we're seeing out there in the world. We should be patiently sitting in our hands instead.
I just felt like I needed to take a breath right there. Just, you know, non-judgmental moment. Jonathan, thank you for joining us today.
Bruce, thanks for having me.
Really appreciate your insight. Jonathan Deyo is a financial advisor. His book is Mindful Investing: Right Focus, Better Outcome, Greater Well-Being. Coming up, do you have to pay the underused housing tax? You might not even know what it is, who's it for, who's excluded, who's included. Coming up next, financial planner Jason Heath will tell us what it is all about. I am the money columnist for a TV show called Cityline. It's a lifestyle show. It airs daily across North America. Lots of tips and tricks on everything in your life. But when it comes to money, I talk about spending and saving and, you know, having tough conversations about money. Those segments are, those interviews are online at cityline.tv. Then search for me.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The Canadian government implemented something called the Underused Housing Tax. It's an annual tax on the ownership of vacant or underused housing in Canada. Usually, it is focused on non-citizen or non-permanent resident owners, but that is not always the case. We're going to talk more about this tax and how it works with Jason Heath. He is a fee-only, advice-only certified financial planner at Objective Financial Partners. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
We talk a ton about housing. I mean, we talk about it around the dinner table, at the park. We talk about it on this show. And there have been many efforts to try and address the multifaceted issue that this is. One of them is taxation. Mm-hmm. This is something from the federal government. Tell us what the underused housing tax is.
Yes. So the underused housing tax was implemented as part of the 2021 federal budget, actually, but it came into effect for the 2022 tax year. And I find it sort of went under the radar, because when the government talked about who it applies to, generally speaking, it's meant for, as you alluded to, non-resident, non-citizen Canadians. So people in other countries who might, you know, buy real estate, park money in Canadian real estate, and it's a 1% tax that is payable every year on the value of that real estate. But there are actually quite a few Canadian residents, Canadian citizens who this tax may apply to that don't know it.
How does the tax work? Like, how do they determine if it is vacant or underused? Are they putting a camera outside your house and seeing if anybody's going in and out? Like, if you have a kegger once a quarter, are you fine?
It's not quite so much oversight, and part of it obviously is on the honor system, I guess, so to speak, with steep penalties for non-compliance. So not quite as much oversight as that, but again, I think with a lot of the Canadians that probably overlooked this if and when they even heard about it in the first place, they may not know that there could be penalties and there may be a need to file an underused housing tax return in order to claim an exemption.
Oh, wow, we're going to talk about that. So 1% on $1 million house, if I'm doing the math right, is 10 grand.
Per year, yes.
Per year. That is not an insignificant sum. No. Put that in the context of the penalty. So, you know, if you don't do it for 5 years, you will save 50 grand, but you are exposed to how much in terms of a penalty?
Yeah, so beyond the interest on the tax that could be payable, there's penalties for non-compliance, and those penalties are $5,000 for an individual per property per year, and $10,000 for a non-individual. And the non-individual component actually could end up applying to a number of different Canadians. So pretty steep amounts that are payable. And this actually is on top of some cities have vacant housing taxes, for example. This is a federal underused housing tax that applies.
Yeah, and those are the ones I'm more familiar with because I don't know, for whatever reason, you hear about them more. Mm-hmm. Why was this designed to focus on non-citizens and non-residents? I mean, shouldn't it be agnostic to who owns the property?
Yeah, you would think, right? I think that part of it was in response to concerns about foreign money having an influence on the Canadian housing market. And I guess it's a lot easier to levy a tax to people who don't vote in Canada, for example, that might be right. Part of it. But again, you know, Canadians are generally exempt, Canadian citizens, Canadian residents, but there are some circumstances where they may need to file.
Which is what we want to get to now. What are the circumstances in which Canadian residents need to file?
So a real easy one is if somebody has a private corporation that owns real estate, residential real estate specifically. So somebody has a corporation that owns a condo, owns a house, and they rent it out. That corporation has a requirement to file an underused housing tax return. If the corporation's owned by a Canadian, there's no tax payable. They don't have to worry about this 1%. But they do need to file in order to claim an exemption. And if a corporation forgets to file, isn't aware they need to file, there could be a $10,000 penalty per property for that corporation. Will the government actually levy the penalty to innocent Canadians who were unaware? You know, remains to be seen, but that's a big number to make a mistake on.
How complex a filing is this, and does it go alongside the current cadence on tax? Like, is it just another page you can add to your filing?
And unfortunately, it's not part of the regular tax filing that you would do in April. So there is an extra underused housing tax return where you need to provide a bunch of information specifically about the property. A corporation, like we were just talking about, may need to file for a special identification number in order to submit the tax return in order to claim the exemption and avoid the penalty. So there's a little extra work involved. And for the 2022 tax year, tax returns are normally due April 30th. There was a six-month extension. So there's an upcoming October 31st deadline that applies for anyone who didn't file for 2022 who might just be learning about it now.
This is a relatively recent move. What would you say about how easy it is for people to catch up. If they're listening to our conversation and they're like, whoa, hold on, I better figure this out because I don't want to suffer the penalty. Well, do you go back to the beginning as soon as it was launched?
Yeah, you know, the 2022 was the first year this applies. Anyone who didn't file gets until October 31st. So nobody's late if they're hearing this now. One of the challenges is some accountants and accounting firms are not filing these returns. Some are worried about the penalties and some of the uncertainty and are sort of deferring to people to file on their own. But there's beyond corporations, beyond non-residents, non-citizens, there are other situations where people might get caught up in needing to file one of these returns to claim an exemption that are not maybe as obvious. And one of the categories is a trust that owns residential property. And most people think, well, I don't have a trust. I'm not a billionaire with a trust, a family trust where I need to file. But there can be situations where, for example, a parent has an adult child on title for their home for probate or estate planning purposes, but the parent really owns the home and has beneficial ownership. Or on the flip side, an adult child who puts their mom or their dad on title for mortgage approval, that could be an example of a trust that has to file an underused housing tax return to avoid a $10,000 penalty as well.
Right. What's your hypothesis as to why people would leave these homes vacant? In today's housing market, it seems ridiculous. Like, get a property manager, rent it out.
It's a good question. One of the things that I have found is that some landlords end up in situations with tenants where maybe a tenant isn't paying or they're having a problem removing a tenant. And obviously there's tenant protections in place for a reason, but some landlords find it difficult, I suppose, maybe to have a tenant. I don't know if it would be enough to forgo the rental income. Some other people, it seems like in particular, non-residents see it as an opportunity to park money in Canada. There has been some documentation of that, and that's one of the reasons this underused housing tax was put in place. But I don't know. I mean, most rental properties in Canada, you'd expect to get 3-5% per year just from the rental income.
Yeah. So let's assume people smarten up and they do decide to get these things rented. What are some of the things people should know about the taxation on rental income? Does it come through at your, marginal tax rate? If it's personal, what can you write off? Those kinds of things.
So rental income is relatively easy. There's a schedule on your tax return where you report your gross rental income received, but you can also deduct expenses like mortgage interest, property taxes, condo fees, utilities, things like that, property manager. And oftentimes a property that has a mortgage on it, especially if it's a relatively large mortgage, will have expenses that are almost as much as the income, such that there is no net rental income to pay tax on. Your expenses might wipe out the income. It's only the net amount that you pay tax on. So a lot of rental properties, there's not a significant amount of tax to pay. And that just goes with earning income of any sort. There's always tax implications.
It seems like an intractable problem these days, with the need for housing never being greater, and yet it's not an easy game to make money, to make a real return on your investment, given how expensive it is to rent money these days.
That's just it. You know, with mortgage interest costs where they are, I've seen lots of people who had variable rate mortgages and they were slightly cash flow negative on a rental property, but they were okay with it. I mean, the property was going up in value, so they didn't mind. Suddenly they're very cash flow negative. The property is not appreciating in some places, in some cases going down in value. I think there's a lot of people starting to reconsider rental properties, and rental properties should not provide a huge rate of return from capital appreciation. It really should come from income. So I think people need to be cautious about counting on high appreciation to make their rental property make sense.
Very interesting stuff. Jason, thank you for joining us to talk about it today.
For sure, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
Jason Heath is a fee-only, advice-only certified financial planner. His firm is Objective Financial Partners. And we were talking about this underused housing tax, the who, what, when, where of it, and how it might actually apply to you, even if you've never heard of it before. That is our show for today. A big thanks to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. If you have feedback for us or story ideas or questions or thoughts or whatever, our email address is ask@moolala.ca. ask@moolala.ca. If you want to sign up for our newsletter, we send one out once a month, literally. That is all that's the frequency, once a month. So you can subscribe at moolala.ca. If you are a social media addict, we are at Bruce Celery on X, Twitter. I'm still not used to that. Bruce Celery, Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.